Athens, the Retsina is still flowing, the parties continuing into the small hours. In Copenhagen, in Stockholm, in Oslo, in Reykjavik, the tears are flowing at the end of what has been an extraordinary festival of divine sport. Yes, this has been the week of the Rest is History World Cup of Gods. Tom Holland, have you enjoyed yourself?
I've enjoyed it so much. I think it truly has been a festival of divine sport. But I think that I should mention, for the benefit of those who may have absolutely no idea what you're going on about, think you're hallucinating. This week on Twitter, we've been holding a World Cup of Gods where people vote for in a knockout contest. We are speaking in the aftermath of the final. Dominic's given some hefty clues there as to who made the final, but we won't announce the results. And what we'll do is we'll go through the first 16. So we've got eight group matches there, and we'll talk about each match, discuss the god that got knocked out, and then we'll go through the quarterfinals, the semifinals, to the final, discussing each god in turn. So lots of divine sport to look forward to. But Dominic, first of all, I think we should dedicate this episode to the person who made it all possible, who was your son, wasn't it?
Yes, my nine-year-old son. So we did a World Cup of British Prime Ministers, which was quite interesting in revealing what, Twitter users who listen to the Rest of History think about Britain's Prime Ministers anyway. And my son thought this was quite amusing but ultimately quite boring exercise, and said, why don't you have a World Cup that people would actually care about, which is one of ancient gods? And so we did. And it has been good fun. There's been a lot of controversy about so my son's favorite god is Horus, and we never even picked Horus. Tom, would you like to explain our rationale for the gods that we did and didn't pick?
Yeah, so we didn't want to cause needless offense. So we didn't want to have never. Gods that people are still worshipping appearing in Twitter polls and getting knocked out by dog-headed Prince Philip and so on. So the specification was that only those gods were eligible that at some point over the course of history had ceased to be worshipped.
So Odin, for example, is still worshipped by a few people, but there was a point where nobody worshipped him.
Right. So a temple to Odin has just opened in Iceland, I think. But that's kind of very recent. Likewise, in Greece, there are shrines to the Olympians, but again, they're kind of late 20th century resurrection. Yeah. So basically, it's dead gods.
Okay.
And I think that's interesting for the number of gods that therefore didn't make it. So gods from India, from China, from Japan and Oceania.
So places where there's more continuity, I suppose you could argue.
Absolutely. So there's been a lot of talk on the sports forums, obviously, about this tournament. And here is Ollie O'Connor with a kind of very interesting point that with this draw, we're guaranteed an Olympian in the final. So he's dwelling on the way that the Greek gods basically dominate the entry lists, highlighting once again their stranglehold on the fan base over the past 600 years. Throw in an Egyptian and Norse god as the others, and it begs the question, how do we grow or diversify the game? And again, John Midgley is his continued Eurocentricity will do nothing to calm the fans, that the tournament is as ever being stitched up for the big money TV markets of ancient Greece and the early Viking period.
There's a serious answer to that, though, isn't there, Tom? That the way you would diversify the game, is by people no longer worshipping Asian gods or you know Chinese, Indian, whatever. I mean, the reason we probably didn't include them is not just because we're European, so we tend to be more interested in Europe. I mean, that's what we study at school, but also because having a tournament with Ishtar and Cybele and Loki and Dionysus, you're not going to offend anybody because they're all defunct. They've all been superseded by monotheisms,
which is
not the case of some of these others, presumably.
I mean, the interesting and serious point to be made here is the way that Christianity and Islam have operated as kind of neutron bombs, incinerating gods. So it's Europe, the Near East, where Christianity and Islam have really established themselves. There is no place for other gods, and so they've all gone.
Although, Tom, might we not discuss this during the podcast, that a lot of these gods, actually, or at least some of them, have in various ways been incorporated into that's what's actually I found fascinating about this, sort of reading up on all the gods, is the extent to which some of them blend into each other, and then they all ultimately flow into what we think of as the invaders that destroyed them.
Well, so there are two particularly controversial participants in the last 16, Moloch and Bridget, both of whom may not even have been gods.
Yeah, may not have existed, whereas, of course, all the others did exist.
Yeah, well, let's not get into the theological.
But yeah.
So Moloch and Bridget were both included. I think you would agree that there was some opposition from you to my pressing for them.
I didn't mind Moloch because I liked the child eating. Bridget, I just thought, I'd never heard of Bridget. So I was very scornful. And in fact, there were a few people on Twitter who weighed in on Bridget and were like, what? How have you picked somebody nobody's ever heard of?
But one for the Irish fans.
One for the Irish fans, though. There was some debate about, I mean, even my wife, who is Irish, said, who the hell is Bridget?
Right, well, we'll come to Bridget and we'll find why I think that she was a worthwhile candidate. But should we come to the first match of the group stages, which was Zeus against Moloch?
Well, Moloch is a great god, I think, because he's everything you want from a god. He's mentioned in Leviticus. He's Canaanite, so Phoenician. And he's involved with child sacrifice. So he sort of ticks the boxes of what you assume a generic ancient god will be, but he may not even have existed at all. Am I right, Tom? He may just be a complete figment.
So Moloch essentially seems to have been the ritual of child sacrifice.
Yeah.
And so therefore it is contested whether what is being described in the Old Testament is a god or a ritual, because basically the Old Testament is the only evidence that we have for it.
So this is like, they're tophets or whatever they're called, there are these altars where you sacrifice children. Is that right?
Well, again, which is, I think, only mentioned it in the Old Testament. And it seems to be a shrine in a place called Gehenna, which is a valley near Jerusalem, where we're told child sacrifice happens.
Yeah.
But again, it may be a more kind of general description for a place where child are offered up to a god.
What's I found fascinating reading about this is, am I right in thinking that these sacrifices may actually have been made to the god of Judaism, to Yahweh? So, for example, that Abraham and Isaac, that story may be a sort of remembered version of the sacrifices that were happening.
So the question is, if Moloch was not a god, if it's a description of a sacrifice, what god were these children being sacrificed? There's a passage in Jeremiah where he says that it's to Baal, who is the great god of the Canaanites, kind of king of the Canaanite gods.
I wanted Baal in the tournament, but I
know you did. But we're discussing Baal under the rubric of Moloch.
Yeah, but I've got Baal's got a name check.
Baal, of course, is the great rival of Yahweh, the god of the Jews, becomes the god of the Christians as well. But what you also get in Jeremiah is kind of first person commentary from Yahweh insisting that he did not demand child sacrifice.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And there's a possibility that he's slightly protesting too much.
Right. That's a strong thing to say about God, Tom.
So Jeremiah 19:5, this is something I did not command or mention, nor did it even enter my mind.
Right.
And you think, well, okay.
There's something very Boris Johnson about that, isn't there?
slightly. So, and of course, so then if actually the Old Testament bears witness to the kind of buried memories of these rituals, and I think that there's quite a lot of evidence that aspects of cultic worship that are condemned by the Hebrew prophets may actually have been applied. These were cultic practices associated with a figure of Yahweh. So
they're cleaning up their own religion. Yeah.
Slightly. Yes, I think so.
And Moloch has become a symbol of that to some extent.
Well, sacrificing a child is obviously
controversial
for us because we're the heirs of that.
Yeah,
that tradition, that moral heritage, absolutely repellent. I mean, we view it as highly, what the most disgusting thing that you can do. But there's there is evidence, I think, as you said, with the sacrifice of Abraham being asked to sacrifice Isaac, and then of course shadowing it, the way in which there's a sense that God in the Christian tradition is sacrificing his son, or there are kind of echoes perhaps of the relationship of father and a son, and the son being sacrificed, that perhaps goes back to this. I mean, obviously these are very contested issues and very deep waters, But the other thing, I think the other thing, moving away from the purely biblical, is that there is evidence as well in for this happening from classical authors.
Right. And is this in Carthage? Are we moving on to Carthage now?
Well, there's evidence from a guy called Philo of Byblos, who is writing in the first century AD, who says that basically the people of Phoenicia would do this, that the kings would sacrifice their children, and they would do it as not because they wanted to get rid of their children, but precisely the opposite, that children are the most precious thing to them. And so therefore that is what you offer to the gods in a desperate situation, because only if you offer something that's absolutely precious to you.
There's a great scene of this in, have you ever read Flaubert's novel, Salammbô?
Yes. Yes.
Where there's a huge scene, isn't there, where they sacrifice all the children in the Punic War. They're fighting. And it's not the Punic War, is it? They're fighting some mercenaries.
Yes, they're fighting the mercenaries after the first Punic War.
And isn't Hannibal is spared? Hamilcar sends another child instead of Hannibal or something. And Hannibal is spared so that he's going to fight clearly the Romans later on.
Yes, and then anyway, he swears his oath.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot, kind of an assumption that this was Roman propaganda. And perhaps that it wasn't true, but they have, you know, there is archaeological evidence for it. They have found kind of cult centers where there's evidence for child sacrifice, and there's a brilliantly creepy illustration from a cemetery, a kind of shattered tower in a Punic cemetery, Phoenician cemetery, Carthaginian cemetery on the coast of Spain, where there's a kind of a baby in a bowl being being offered to this kind of two-headed monster who's holding a pig.
Right. What's the pig going to... Where's the pig going to come in?
I don't know. That's the other thing. There's so much we don't know. Right. And it's all just incredibly weird and very, I think, very sinister. So perhaps we should put that up.
Maybe when
we link to this on Twitter or something, we could put a picture of that thing, because it's very, very creepy. And so I think that I'm not surprised that Moloch got knocked out.
Yeah, I was about to say Moloch got knocked out.
pretty horrible. But he also has a starring role in Paradise Lost.
Horrid Milton King besmeared with the blood of human sacrifice and parents' tears. Milton's not messing around, is he?
No. And I think that does kind of haunt the imagination. Still, so I think that even though Moloch may not even have existed, I think that he deserved his place. But I wasn't surprised to see him go out.
So let's move on to another fodder at the first hurdle. Chipitotec. Chipitotec was up against Odin. Now Chipitotec was another of yours. You were very keen on Chippy.
Yeah.
He's a colourful character. There's a lot of sacrifice going on with him. He's Aztec. He's from what, the 14th, 15th century. Tell us about Chipitotec, Tom.
Well, we discussed him briefly in the episode with Camilla Townsend on the Aztecs. And I mentioned there how years ago there was an exhibition on the Aztecs in the Royal Academy, and there was a statue of Chipitotec there, and he looked rather adorable because he had kind of bubbles all over him.
Yeah,
so he
bubbly.
Looked like a children's character.
Yeah.
You know, a lovable cartoon character.
It's like a Michelin man, almost.
Yes,
more bubbly than that.
Yes, yes. Kind of, you know, the inside of an Aero, kind of chocolate bar, bubbles of chocolate.
Maltesers.
Yes. But actually what these bubbles are the deposits of fat of the inside of a flayed skin.
Lovely.
And Chipitotec is known as the flayed one, because what he does is he skins himself. And by doing that, he is giving food to humanity. So he's the god of fertility and agriculture. His festival is in the spring. It's all about the way that the earth gives forth new life from death and all those kind of rituals. But it's done in a very, very terrifyingly literal way, because increasingly we heard again that from Camilla Townsend, that as the Aztec power grows and grows, so the rites of sacrifice grew and grew. And prisoners are skinned, and the priests of Chipitotec then wear these skins for 20 days.
They must have stank. They must have, I mean, the stench.
Horrible.
Tom.
I mean, and after 20 days, they put them in pots and let them rot away. And these pots have kind of special seals, so they don't smell.
I wonder whether this was, so Chipitotec, I discovered from my reading, was also associated with pimples, rashes, and eye infections. And I wonder whether that was because, I mean, if you go around wearing somebody else's skin for 20 days, you're going to develop. I mean, your own skin will be in a poor condition, presumably afterwards.
I guess that would be part of it. But I think also what we see with all these gods, and it's obviously a crucial part of what makes them worthwhile contenders in the World Cup, is that they can do offence and defence. They can do you good and they can do you evil.
Yeah.
And they're a compound of often of what seems to us opposites. And so absolutely, Chippy provides people with the food that they need to survive.
But he'd give you a bad eye infection.
He will give you all spots or something.
Yeah. Straight. I mean, that's such an incredibly banal detail. I'm amazed that, I mean, to think of the god of eye infections wouldn't strike me as an obvious, you know, I see the Aztecs in a very different light now that I know that.
But there's also the sense, you know, the deeper sense that, and we talked about how the priests of Chippy like to stab their penises with thorns.
Of course. Yeah.
And I don't think it's an episode of the rest of the history, unless
we've got some mutilation coming up later, actually.
Yeah, we've got quite a lot of genital mutilation, but let's get in there early. And so the Aztecs had the feeling that unless you were offering blood to the gods, unless the gods were drinking it, then darkness would threaten the whole world.
Yeah.
So,
and that's kind of common across most of these ancient religions, right? I mean, that's clearly a universal human belief. We're probably unusual in not believing.
I mean, I suppose, but even in the Christian tradition, you know, drink this blood.
Yes, and Jesus shedding his blood for us. And all
yeah,
that
so
stuff,
so
yeah.
So the idea of divine blood is a constant, and again, something I think that we'll see running throughout this contest.
Well, for a very colourful, exotic god, if that doesn't sound too sort of orientalising, he performed very poorly, I thought.
Against Odin, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was, but even so, I thought the flayed one, the skin and all that, I thought that would win him a few brownie points.
But possibly doesn't have cut through.
Clearly not.
I mean, and this is kind of why the gods, you know, the major gods are talking about setting up a Super League. We just got to hope that they don't go through with that, because
Chippy did his best,
important.
But he just didn't resonate with. Yeah, he's this Keir Starmer of Aztec gods.
I really don't think that Chippy Totec and Keir Starmer are a natural fit. But I think, you know, as Ollie O'Connor said, it's important to grow and diversify the game.
Yeah,
and a World Cup of gods in which you have Aztecs.
It's got to be
a more exciting cup.
I wanted to have Hernan Cortez.
but we know that he wasn't a god now.
Well, I know, but I mean, there was some doubt at some point, wasn't there? Anyway, let's move on. Next god. Are we going to do, should we do Ishtar next?
We've got, Mithras against Ishtar.
So this was a nice one, because this was an all-Asian clash, really, wasn't it?
Well, we might discuss that.
But Ishtar.
Whether Mithras really is a Persian god.
Yes, okay.
But Ishtar is definitely a Mesopotamian god. So are you a fan of Ishtar?
I actually wasn't bothered about Ishtar, but once I read up on Ishtar, I thought she was very interesting.
So she's also known as Inanna.
Inanna, right. And she's Sumerian, so incredibly old, much older than most of these gods, and again has this huge continuity. So am I not right in thinking that people think that Ishtar, because she's a goddess of love, that she inspired Aphrodite, that she's a kind of forerunner for Aphrodite? Well, you all know more about this than me, Tom. I don't know why I'm even talking.
Well, so Inanna is the goddess of the patron goddess of Uruk, which is one of the very earliest cities, perhaps the earliest city. She then becomes the patron of Sargon of Akkad, who is kind of conventionally thought of as the first imperialist, the first man to carve out an empire. And he has a kind of Moses and the bulrushes story. So he gets, you know, rather like Moses, he gets cast out, gets rescued. Works as a gardener.
As you do.
And then Ishtar falls in love with him and raises him up to become the greatest king in the world. And so that kind of basically makes her reputation as well. The worship of her goes right the way through to Assyria. She's the great kind of patron of the Assyrian kings and patron of the Babylonian kings. And again, we talked about Chippy being the god of the harvest and of zits, in a rather similar way. Ishtar is a war goddess, So that's the role that she plays as the patron of Assyria, this terrifying militaristic empire. But she's also the goddess of love.
That's an interesting thing, isn't it, with a lot of these gods, that obviously their meaning changes over time. But they take on different roles, don't they? I mean, we see this much later on with the Greek gods and goddesses, that they sort of almost, they're almost imperialists in themselves, and they sort of accumulate territory. They
kind of absorb stuff.
Yeah, they do.
Ishtar is the goddess of love. She kind of casts this erotic spell over Uruk. So Uruk is cast as, I suppose really it's the first metropolis to serve the role that cities have always played since, which is as a place where people come to experience the erotic in the way that they might not do in villages or out in the fields.
Yeah.
And so again, what the followers of Ishtar, you get this kind of haze of myth that scholars debate whether it's real or not. But there's, for a long time, it's believed that Ishtar was the patroness of sacred prostitution. I think it's not widely thought that that happened. But you also get her priests are cross-dressing, men sleeping with men, all this kind of stuff, reports of copulation in the streets.
And are these exaggerated, do you think, or are they real?
I don't know, but there's a kind of sense of a kind of slight, you know, gay pride parade quality to her worship, which I think is, I mean, you know, the sexual standards are completely different to ours, but at the same time, the sense that you can obviously go beyond the bounds of the normal, and if you're a man, you can dress as a woman or sleep with another man or whatever, is given license by Ishtar, and that's the kind of the locus of her power.
She's not the only god that does that, right? I mean, we're going to come across other gods
too. Some more as well.
So there's always a role of a god who's a kind of, who gives you a license. You know, when you associate yourself with this god, or when they have a festival or something, all the traditional rules are suspended and you can kind of crack on and do whatever you like.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's all part of the fun. And Ishtar is a goddess who pushes at the limits. So there's a kind of famous story that gets told several times, including in Gilgamesh, the famous epic. But the core of the story is that she has a sister who's the goddess of the dead.
Right.
And Ishtar goes down essentially because she wants to annex, you know, you're talking about how gods annex things. Ishtar basically wants to kind of take over the realm of the dead as well as the realm of the living. And she goes through seven gates, and at each gate she discards, you know, some jewelry, clothing, attributes of her power. She ends up basically naked and powerless and is struck down dead. Everybody on earth loses their libido. So it's a kind of anti-Viagra.
Right. Yeah.
Nobody can perform. Enki, the wise god, creates these kind of gender fluid rescuers who go down and bring her back. She comes back, she finds everyone is weeping, except for her husband, Dumuzid, who he's kind of hanging out in the garden and he doesn't really care. So Ishtar's incredibly cross about that, kills him, sends him down to the underworld in her place, regrets it, tries to get him back. And there's a kind of Persephone story whereby he comes back for 6 months to be with her.
Interesting. Yeah.
And
that's another theme that comes up again and again in these god stories, isn't it? Yeah. Death and rebirth, or the fertility and sort of, I mean, that's obviously associated with the seasons and all that sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and one last thing on Ishtar is that although her worship fades away in the Christian and the Muslim period in the Near East, she has a brother called Shamash, who is the god of the sun. And I went to a place called Lalish in northern Iraq, which is holy to the Yazidis, this kind of religious minority. And it's a very syncretic faith, the kind of elements of Judaism and Islam and Christianity and Zoroastrianism, all kind of there. But they have a room, a chamber, that is sacred to a holy man called Sheikh Shams. And he is in some way associated with the sun. And so there are scholars who think that this might be a living link to Shamash and therefore to Ishtar, because Shamash is the brother of Ishtar. Nice. So I don't think that disqualifies Ishtar, because we're talking about Shamash rather than Ishtar. But you know, there is this perhaps...
There are elements that are still alive.
Living elements still there in northern Iraq, which is kind of wonderful.
Simone de Beauvoir was a big fan of Ishtar. In The Second Sex, she says that Ishtar has been written out of history by patriarchal men, and that feminists should champion, Ishtar.
And it's her case is proven by the fact that Mithras,
well,
the god of the Roman soldiery, beat her. So classic patriarchal maneuver. And I think on that note, we should go for a break, shouldn't we?
We probably should, actually. I think we're talking too much, Tom.
Yes.
But okay. When we come back after the break, we'll talk less and we'll move more quickly through our gods. See you in a minute. Welcome back to The Rest is History. Tom Holland and I are discussing the World Cup of Gods. We've talked about Moloch, Chipitotec, and Ishtar. And now, Tom, Bridget. So Bridget was a controversial choice. Irish, some would say not a god. Explain yourself.
Okay, so Bridget is generally held up as an example of a god who becomes a saint. So Saint Bridget of Kildare, one of the great saints of the Irish tradition.
Yeah.
And so people have debated whether Saint Bridget existed, and essentially whether when Catholics pay their respects to Saint Bridget, they're actually paying respect to a pagan god. And
because did this happen a lot in early Christianity, that they absorbed local cults and stuff as a sort of, branding takeover kind of
thing? Well, that's been a kind of popular accusation against the Catholic cult of saints since at least the time of Hume, who makes exactly that point. And the evidence for Bridget having been a god, there are, so there's a god, the goddess of Yorkshire, Brigantia.
Yes.
So we know that she's worshipped in Britain. There's a sculpture found in Dumfries with an inscription saying that she's called Brigantia. And so it's been popularly thought that Brigantia and Bridget, you know, similar names, maybe the same person. And also there is, in the 9th century in Ireland, there is Cormac's Glossary, it's called, refers to Bridget being a goddess. And she's part of this kind of pantheon of the Irish gods that, you know, has faded by the 9th century.
And she's
so that's the basis for thinking that.
And she's a poet, she's a healer, and she's a poet. Smith. Is that right?
That's right.
A tripartite god.
What Cormac's Glossary says.
Yeah.
But there is an alternative way of seeing it, which is to say that actually the evidence for Saint Bridget is much better than there having been a goddess called Bridget. And that perhaps actually it's the other way round. That perhaps you have a saint who mutates into a goddess, so that people come to think Irish chroniclers come to think that this goddess had existed. And the reason for thinking this is put forward in a very interesting paper by a scholar called Lisa Battelle, and you can read it online, so it's available, well worth reading. And her argument is that Bridget of Kildare did exist, that she was believed to have performed all kinds of miracles, that she came from a very humble background. She was the daughter of a slave. And yet she ends up a very powerful figure that kind of, you know, an abbess, the friend of abbots, patron of kings. And so there is a challenge in working out how to portray her power.
Yeah.
So there are stories, that kind of wonderful stories that are told of her, that she hung her cloak on a sunbeam, that she turned water into beer. I mean, brilliant stuff. And you can see why she's, you know, kind of popular in Ireland.
A sunbeam.
It's a wonderful, wonderful detail. But the way to, this is a period where women do not have power.
Yeah.
No, and the only example of women exercising power is in the dimension of the supernatural. And so Saint Bridget comes to be associated with the attributes of gods. So the power that she exercises over the landscape, over the animals, over the earth and the sun and the rain, these are powers that kind of derive from the fading pagan traditions.
So she's a saint at the same time as there are pagan. So Ireland is not yet fully Christianized. Is that basically the argument?
And she absorbs elements that are associated with goddesses, because these are the only way that Christian writers can express the power of this woman. Because otherwise, the idea that a woman could have power, spiritual power, is so strange that there is no other way of demonstrating it. So I think that that's a fascinating story.
It's a good story, but it wasn't convincing to the Twitterati.
No, clearly. It wasn't. No.
Because she performed very... I mean, she was up against Apollo, and Apollo is kind of the Greek god. But even so, she performed quite poorly, didn't she? I thought. I mean, did she even get 30% of the vote?
I don't think she did, no.
Oh, Tom.
No.
Tom.
So a shame. So she got knocked out. But I thought, I mean, that's an interesting story, isn't it?
It is an interesting story. And you claimed when you selected her that there would be an interesting story, and there has been. So you've been vindicated, even if no one voted for it. All right, who have we got up next?
We've got Augustus Caesar.
Now, this is an interesting one because he quite patently is a man. I mean, and we are going to do a whole podcast, I hope, on Augustus, because I think he's clearly one of the two or three, you know, most important, most effective, most influential political leaders in human history.
Yeah. The most in European history, I would say.
The most in European history. Yeah, I'm sure that's probably true. I mean, it's hard to think of anyone who would conceivably rival him, actually. So at what point is he deified? He's deified after his death, right? He's not deified in his lifetime, or not fully deified. Is that right?
Well, he's worshipped as a god outside Rome, but then he has
his
funeral.
In the East, I suppose, no doubt.
In AD 14, he dies. His body is taken back to Rome, and they stage this incredible kind of pyrotechnical extravaganza with flames and, I mean, equivalent to fire. They don't have fireworks.
So for people who don't know, he is Octavian. He is the adopted heir of Julius Caesar.
Who is a god.
Yeah, who had been deified.
And so one of the names he has, this isn't a title, it's his name, is Son of a God.
Yeah. So he's defeated Mark Antony and Cleopatra. He's become the first emperor of Rome and created this new structure. And then he's deified, and that sort of, he's picking up that tradition from Julius Caesar, but then he's passing that on to all subsequent emperors. That they're all deified, aren't they? Unless they're sort of driven out in...
No.
Oh, right. Okay.
They're not. So Tiberius' son isn't. Caligula obviously isn't. Claudius is. Nero isn't. And so it basically depends whether you measure up or not.
If you're a successful emperor, you're deified then. But put it that way. Yes.
But Augustus is the kind of the archetype of the great emperor, and therefore the archetype of an emperor who becomes deified. So his very name, Augustus, essentially, it signifies someone who's midway between earth and heaven. So the sense that he is a supernatural figure, a more than human figure, is there right the way from the time. Basically from the moment that Julius Caesar is deified, because Augustus is his adopted son, and that therefore, in the opinion of the Romans, is his son. He has this quality of the divine about him. The name Augustus gives him a further quality. And by the final year of his life, you know, he's starting to fall ill, but there are all these kind of portents, rumors around him showing that he's going to go to the heavens. And when he, at his funeral, a senator says that he has seen his spirit rising up to the sky, and that's enough. So he gets enshrined as a god. And in the first century AD, this is by miles the fastest spreading cult. It's probably the fastest spreading cult across a broader range that history had ever seen. Because everywhere in the Roman Empire, this cult is being instituted.
And what's so fascinating about this, though, Tom, and what I think makes this in some ways a more fascinating story than almost any other of the contenders, is that it makes us rethink, you know, in the sort of 21st century, we think of mortal and immortal as two completely separate categories, don't we? Natural and supernatural, God and human. And, you know, most people who are atheists who are listening to this podcast will think, well, people in the past were very backward and they thought that there were strange creatures in the sky and all this sort of stuff. But Augustus's deification suggests a much more complicated relationship between mortal and immortal. Because, of course, people didn't think that, I mean, they didn't think he had powers. You know, the people who had worked with him, who had been his sort of civil servants, who had trudged in with the paperwork every morning and discussed tax policies, knew that he didn't, you know, they didn't think of him as God in the same, as a sort of Marvel superhero film.
No
sense of the gods, did they? It's a much more complicated and nuanced picture than that. It's about authority and about tradition and all this sort of stuff, right?
But I think it's also gratitude because Rome has been ravaged by civil war, and Augustus essentially is the man who brings peace. So Augustus is, you know, he's the son of a god. He brings peace to a ravaged world. The people who support him proclaim this as, and we have inscription saying it, that it's euangelia, so good news.
Interesting. Evangel. Yeah, very interesting. Yeah.
And then when he dies, he goes to heaven and sits at the right hand of his divine father. So there's nothing odd about that. The people of the Roman Empire take for granted that great people will, you know, can become gods. lurking behind this, of course, is another cult that emerges in the first century of a son of a god who is a prince of peace, who ascends to heaven and sits at the right hand of his father.
Yes.
What's shocking about the deification of Jesus isn't the fact that a mortal is becoming immortal, but that a slave is doing, someone who suffers.
So it's a mortal who's a nobody rather than an immortal.
And so there's a sense in which, St. Paul, when he goes to Galatia, you know, he writes his letter to the Galatians. Galatians seems to have been a particular cult center for Augustus. A lot of what we know about Augustus, his autobiography, the accounts of that come from Galatia. And so there's a sense, I think, in which Paul certainly is very aware of the fact that the euangelion, the gospel, the good news that he's bringing is a parody of the cult of Augustus.
But also, before we move on, isn't Augustus's cult like Julius Caesar's cult? They're clearly picking up, aren't they, on the sort of Hellenistic. So Alexander the Great had been a god. Philip II of Macedon, Alexander's father, had had godlike attributes. The Ptolemies in Egypt had been worshipped as gods, as pharaohs had. And that the Romans are basically picking up, as their empire has expanded and they've moved into the Eastern Mediterranean, aren't they picking up a lot of that sort of stuff and then transporting it back to Rome in place of the sort of slightly more Republican kind of Cato-ish values that they'd had before that?
I think part of the appeal of the cult is that different people's different traditions can project their cultural understandings onto the figure of this deified emperor.
Yeah.
So I think that's very interesting. I think Augustus was, you know, absolutely deserved his presence in this World Cup, but again,
he crashed out very poorly.
Athena, the number one seed.
I think
it was always going to be a difficult
a lot of
match
the
for
fans
him.
Just couldn't see past the fact that he had once been a man.
Yeah.
And now let's. Who are we going to do next? Are we going to do?
We've got Loki against Anubis.
So this is the big shock, and I still think. I mean, I voted for Anubis. I wanted Anubis. I'm not going to lie. I wanted Anubis to win because of my own association with him at school when I made my Anubis mask. I was very proud of it. However, Loki is a very interesting god, and he probably should have gone further in the tournament.
Surprised.
Do you not think
he lost?
It's a sort of anti-Tom Hiddleston, though, isn't it? Anti-Marvel Comics backlash, I think.
Do you think? Because I think that Odin and Loki are from, you know, they're well known, perhaps better known than any other god at the moment because of that Marvel dimension.
I think maybe people are a bit bored of him because he's ubiquitous.
Maybe.
And, you know, there's about to be a Loki film or TV series or something, and I think he's just everywhere and there's trailers for it all the time. And
it's a kind of fascinating example of the way in which this, in a sense, is still a living tradition.
Well, I suppose so.
Well, because, you know, notoriously what we know about the gods of the Vikings and is mediated through writers who are Christian by the time they're
writing. Icelandic writers.
And so therefore the issue is always how Christianized has this been, or are these authentic traditions? And in a sense, so it's always being rewritten. And their kind of iteration in the Marvel comics is just another example of that.
I suppose that's true. Well, anyway, let's Loki. So he's a trickster. A lot of people will know that he's the father of Hel and Fenrir, the wolf, and Jormungand, the serpent. That he's also bizarrely the father of Sleipnir, is it? The eight-legged horse.
The eight-legged horse of Odin.
Yes. Loki is impregnated. He is impregnated himself and gives birth to this eight-legged horse. I mean, that's a very peculiar, even by the standards of ancient gods. That's a strange carry-on, isn't it? And then, of course, famously, he tricks Hod into...
The blind brother of Balder.
Of Balder, and shooting Balder, the god who everybody loves. And then he's punished for that, isn't he? There's a serpent drip venom into his face. Is that it?
Yeah, well, there's an intermediate stage because he... the god of the underworld says that Balder can come back if it's shown that everyone is weeping for him. And everyone across creation weeps for him, except for a giantess. And the gods ask, why are you not weeping? And he says, well, the giantess says, oh, don't care. I'm not interested. It's like the person who refuses to go to Diana's funeral or something.
Yeah.
But that turns out to be Loki. And so, then they seize him. They seize him and chain him down and put a serpent that drips poison on his head.
So what's all this, Tom? So this is a very unusual figure because most of the gods we've talked about are people who were, you know, you'd associate yourself with their cult because there was something admirable about the god, or the, or they incarnated some value, you know, love or fertility or whatever. But he's a pretty malignant presence, isn't he?
He's fun, isn't he?
I suppose he is fun. I mean, he's in the kids' stories. So, you know, our house is full of creaking with the weight of kind of Norse myths and stuff. And he's always in them. I mean, when he's not in them, they're very boring. It's Thor hitting a giant with a hammer.
And sometimes sometimes he's helping Thor out, isn't he?
Yes, he is. Sometimes Thor is an absolute fool. And
Loki's there to... I mean, he's kind of divine Odysseus, basically.
Yes, yeah.
And people
Well, that's why the Hiddleston portrayal, I mean, he's much more interesting than Thor in the Marvel comics.
Yes.
Films. You know, Thor is just a sort of beefcake, and Hiddleston is playing this sort of charismatic, sort of smirking...
clever person.
Yeah. I mean, so that makes it weird that he did crash out, actually. But I, again, I think that's a
but
sort of...
But people love dogs. I mean, people like tricksters, but they like dogs even more.
Well, it's, and they're not quite enough, as we found out later
Well, we'll come to that tournament. Yes, the big controversy of the tournament, but we'll save that. Okay, so that was Loki gone. And then we have Kybele.
Right. Yeah. Again, one of your choices.
Yes.
Now, I was mystified by this choice until I did some research and found out about the priests or the associates of Kybele.
But did you find out how old she is?
Very old.
About how old Ishtar is.
Kybele is older. Is Kybele older?
Well, maybe. But it's possible that she goes all the way back to Çatalhöyük. So Kybele is a Phrygian god in Anatolia, what's now Turkey.
Turkey, yeah.
It is thought that her cult ultimately has its origins in at the figure of a mother goddess who is associated with these kind of very, very fat women.
Yeah.
Found at Çatalhöyük, which is this kind of
incredibly ancient city. Because the statues are very, very fat, aren't they, of her?
Yeah. So it's kind of 6,000 BC, something like that. And considering that, her, you know, she's worshipped right the way up to kind of 500 AD, she... Yeah. If that's the case, then she is the deity that has been worshipped longer than any other.
So she's been worshipped almost...
So much longer than, say, you know, the Jewish
three
god.
Three times longer than Jesus so far, yes. Which is extraordinary when you think of it.
So we talked about Akhenaten and Tutankhamun. They are closer to us than they are to
them. Than the first worshippers of Kybele. That...
So I think she deserves, you know, absolute veteran.
And she's a mother goddess. But what's interesting, the Romans adopted her, didn't they? During the Punic War, they brought some stone to Rome.
Yeah, so they get told, so they're fighting the war against Hannibal and they get told to bring the cult of Kybele to Rome. And the ship gets stuck and a noble Roman virgin helps pull it up. And there's a famous painting by Mantegna illustrating that in the National Gallery.
Presumably not single-handed.
I mean, she doesn't. That's the trick.
At some point, has Kybele got the face of a stone? Is that right?
There's all kinds of... Because she's a mother goddess.
Yeah.
And every cult has, you know, everyone has a mother goddess.
Yeah.
She can kind of blur in very easily. And so lots of the statues of Kybele, you know, they're done by Greek sculptors. And so she looks like any Greek god. But there are also these much older traditions where she is associated just with stones or with totems or whatever. And the stories that are told about Kybele are very unlike Greek gods, really. There's a kind of strangeness to it. So essentially there's this thing where she, before she becomes Kybele, she is hermaphroditic. And she then cuts off her testicles.
Right.
Hacks them off, and we're back into the genital mutilation.
Yeah, we're going to get
throws
a
them
bit
away
more of this in a second.
These testicles then grow up to become a fruit tree. A river nymph takes the fruit, puts it to her breast, and becomes pregnant with this fruit. Gives birth to this beautiful youth who's given the name of Attis.
Okay. Yeah.
Kybele then falls in love with Attis, who in a sense is her son.
We're the product of her own testicles that have been turned into a tree. I've lost.
Attis wants to marry someone. Kybele is jealous, turns up at the marriage.
Yeah.
Attis goes mad, cuts off his testicles, runs away from the altar. And Kybele then basically keeps him in kind of suspended animation. So it's the worst wedding ever.
That makes the wedding from Game of Thrones look like a barrel of laughs.
An absolute cakewalk. I mean, imagine if you're the bride and your groom suddenly hacks off his testicle and runs off with his mother. It's a terrible, terrible business.
My God.
So you can see why the Romans are slightly sniffy about it.
Yeah, but then they adopt it. They're like, they're losing a war, and they think, well, what's the obvious thing to do? Let's adopt this really mad religion.
Yeah, but they're adopting this kind of stone element. They're not adopting all the weird shit that goes with it.
Yeah, but then, am I not right in thinking that they do adopt the priests? And the priests, I mean, this is obviously why you chose it, because you love the subject of genital mutilation.
And transvestism.
They're called the Galli, aren't they? And they have the day of blood, as they call it. I'm never a very appealing prospect, I think, in a religious. First of all, the day of blood. Anyway, they have the day of blood. Sorry, I know we shouldn't be laughing at our own podcast. They wave this.
Not funny. I mean, they're chopping off the testicles.
I know, they wave tambourines around, they have a dance, and then they mutilate themselves.
Roaming the streets. And so they spread westwards to Rome, and the Romans are very disapproving of this. So the Romans have adopted the cult of Cybele, but they don't approve of these auto-castrating, cross-dressing priests.
No.
And Seneca says something to the tune of, a cult that requires people to do this isn't a cult that's worth having.
He's not wrong, to be fair. I mean, I think.
I think.
If it's that, I mean, if you had the choice at the time of that or the cult of Augustus, I mean, what do you have to do in the cult of Augustus?
Or, of course, the cult of Christ. And in the long run, it's the worship of Christ that blots out the worship of Cybele. And Julian the Apostate is really the last significant figure who's a big fan of Cybele.
Is he?
The nephew of Constantine. Brought up a Christian, repudiates Christianity, goes back to the worship of Cybele, and goes to the great shrine of Cybele, and is very disappointed to find that it's basically been abandoned. And he writes letters to the priests of Cybele saying, why aren't you handing out alms to the poor and doing charitable work? And the reason for that is that priests of Cybele are too busy hacking off their testicles and roaming the streets dressed as women. And obviously the church doesn't really approve of that. And so it gets...
I kind of think if we had the World Cup now, with people having listened to this,
Cybele might do better.
Do a bit better. Anyway, from one very wacky god to another, the last god of this podcast, anyway, and then we'll do the others in our follow up podcast. The other person who crashed out in the first round, of course, was Prince Philip.
Huge disappointment to me, and I know to you.
Yes, I was gutted that Prince Philip. I thought Prince Philip would do well. He didn't. He was beaten by Dionysus, wasn't he? Quite comfortably, actually.
Tell us why we included Prince Philip.
Well, Prince Philip is, or was, worshipped. He was worshipped on the island of Tanna, which is part of Vanuatu, by the Yaonan tribe. So this is what's called a cargo cult, which probably a lot of our listeners will have heard of. So they mainly flourished in kind of Melanesia in the Pacific after the Second World War. And, I mean, the way to think of it is you have all these islands... where the sort of tribes are living relatively untouched by the outside world. Around about the period of the Second World War, obviously they're visited by lots of Japanese, American soldiers who have a lot of stuff. And the stuff often gets left behind, or the stuff washes up on beaches. And you have what's called cargo cults. So the most famous one concerns a character called John Frum. And some anthropologists think that John Frum means John from America or whatever. And, you know, people on the islands not unreasonably thought, you know, these visitors from another world have come with all this sort of incredible, baffling stuff. And one day they will come back and they will bring more stuff. And they are like visitors from another plane. They are like supernatural visitors.
And so
Philip went to Vanuatu the Queen went to Vanuatu, I think, in 1974. And, you know, how exactly the Prince Philip cult started is unclear. It's probably connected with that visit in the 70s, though it might slightly predate it. If I am being very skeptical, I would say that the single biggest driver of this cult is the fact that every 2 years, people from the newspapers arrive in this village and say to these guys, can you please pose with a picture of Prince Philip
for
amused readers of the Daily Telegraph? And then
and documentaries they make, didn't they? They had a documentary Channel 4 about them.
Channel 4 brought some of them to England. And they met Prince Philip. Now, it may well be, if I'm being completely skeptical, that once the cameras were off and the doors were closed, the tribesmen said to Prince Philip, you know, we're actually perfectly aware that you're not a god, but we fancied the trip to London. I mean, I might be wrong. I might be being too cynical. And actually, they may well believe it.
So Prince Philip, there was a lot of discussion about this in the sports forums. So there was a comment from Jeff Hannum. I wonder if Prince Philip has offended the other gods yet.
Well,
interesting question. I mean, you wouldn't want to offend Chippy, would you?
No, but I think Prince Philip had seen a lot in his life. I think he could cope with, you know, he'd had an interesting life in himself. Maybe Kibele's more outlandish cult would be a bit much for him.
So Gareth Arden makes exactly this point, talking about Prince Philip. Yeah. Seriously, he does have a good godlike backstory. He fled homeland during a perilous war. So like Aeneas, I suppose.
Yeah.
Married the queen. Her father became king after a dynastic squabble of a global empire. A chariot racer, sort of, because he...
Yes, talked about this trapping or whatever it's called.
Yeah. A great athlete, played cricket, marksman, shot pheasants, thrill seeker, crashed Land Rover. So,
yeah.
I mean, when Prince Philip died, I didn't really know very much about him. I just thought he was kind of vaguely boring royal. But he was definitely one of those people who, the more I read his obituaries, the more interesting I realised he was. And I think he would make a good god.
He would make a brilliant deified Roman emperor, wouldn't he? He probably made a very good Roman emperor. I mean, he looked like could have. Kind of imperial.
Well, the thing that Jeff Hannum's saying about has Prince Philip offended other gods? I mean, that kind of quality of the acerbic, I think, is an essential quality for a god, because they can't just be.
Yeah, he's not.
You know, they've got to have a whiff of danger about them.
So a god, I don't think, should have any consideration for sort of health and safety considerations or human resources.
No, I would say that if there's a lesson to be drawn from our study of the gods in this World Cup, a concern with health and safety.
Is not one of them.
Does not feature. And so, I think that's a good note on which to end this episode.
The eight losers. And in our next episode, we're going to talk about the last eight. And we will get through to and reveal the champion for those of you who don't already know. So we will just see you on the next podcast. Cheerio.
Bye-bye.